Okay, ready to go. So the original scheduled title for this class was Sarah as a Mother. But I'm sitting, I started this new thing, I told some of you probably, I wake up now at 6:15 in the morning to give myself some time to myself before the kids wake up, and it's wonderful. I daven every day, I sit and have a coffee like a human being instead of in the car on the way to school. And sometimes I even get to read the newspaper. So I'm reading last week's Tuesday's New York Times. On the bottom half of the front page, there's an article that screamed to me personally so strongly, I said, I have to talk about this in my class. So I'm going to share with you some of this article. And then we threw out the newspaper, so I just want to get it online. And then it's too big already to give out to everybody. So here we go. Dean's wife, son, politics. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's a doctor.
Burlington, Vermont, January 12th. Edie Kasparovitz, 74 and retired from the Seabrook, New Hampshire auto plant that Howard Dean was touring the other day, had a question unrelated to his union's hot-button issues of trade and health care. When, she wondered, will America have a chance to meet her bride? No time soon, Dr. Dean told him, unless you get sick in Shelburne, Vermont, in which case she'll probably see you. Mm-hmm. In 23 years of marriage, 18 of which Dr. Dean has spent running for or serving in office, his wife, Judith Steinberg Dean, has developed an unusual role for the political spouse, invisible. During Dr. Dean's 2 years of relentless campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination, Dr. Steinberg has stood by her husband's side at a political event exactly once, at his official announcement speech here in June. The country doctor who still makes the occasional house call and attends PCA meetings, Dr. Steinberg has given about a dozen interviews, none televised, two fundraising letters, and a cameo and a half-hour advertisement. She has never been to Iowa. I'm not going to read you the whole article, but there are parts you just talked about. It's like, whoa. Okay.
She's dead tonight.
It is a reprise of her performance as First Lady of Vermont. When Dr. Dean became governor, Dr. Steinberg reluctantly danced with the first two inaugural balls in 93 and 95, but that event was soon cut from the state capitol calendar and replaced with an open house, which she skipped. Dr. Dean, for his part, rarely uttered her name, even to say thanks in public speeches. I think a lot of couples are like us, where they have two career couples, and both careers are very important to the individual. Dr. Steinberg, 50, said in an interview this fall, each individual has to do what works for her. What works best for me and what I'm best at is being a doctor. So I'm reading this. I'm like, okay, good. You know, I'm glad that she has her own thing. They don't have cable TV in their house, so she has to watch all the televised debates at the campaign center. She has to go down there if she wants to see them, and she doesn't even really want to see all of them. He quotes, Dr. Dean quotes the husband, I do not intend to drag her around because I think I need her as a prop on the campaign trail, he said last week in Iowa. That sounds very, like, good, you know. If she wanted to do it, it would be great, but she doesn't want to do it, and therefore if she does do it, it won't be great. I just think she should do what she needs to do for her own happiness and satisfaction. Some Dean backers see Dr. Steinberg as a role model for independent women balancing careers and children, but others in the campaign increasingly regard her actions as a potential liability for a candidate who is known for his reluctance to discuss his personal life or upbringing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Snip wears makeup, she wears black shoes, big deal, okay? The basic thing is that she's a doctor, and that's what she does. She's a doctor. She takes care of her children. Her husband, she says, Dr. Dean has spent on average just four nights a month here in Burlington for nearly a year. So Dr. Steinberg and their children are Jewish. He campaigned through Yom Kippur and recited the rest of Shema Blessings via cell phone. He calls home nightly unless he's on the West Coast and fears waking her, but rarely shares tales from the trail. I don't talk politics, he said, with people who aren't interested in politics. He's in politics, and his wife and life partner is not interested in politics. Dr. Steinberg said, I couldn't be more supportive, but I don't show my support by traveling with him. I'd rather be seeing patients. So I read this whole article, and it gets to the end. You know, he says at the end, if I get elected, you'll meet her in the White House. Yeah, you know, and I say, yeah, right. You know, you don't just change overnight. And I called my husband and had this whole heated debate with him on his telephone. I said, the women of America need a role model. She said that, you know, you can see clear parallels in my mind, at least, how I feel a Revitin should be. You know, the people need a leader. They need someone who's involved, not somebody who just is going to sit on the side and do her own thing. You know, of course, you know, your family comes first, but you have to show that you stand by your husband, that you're one, that you work together, that you're, you know, not, it doesn't work in every profession, but in a profession where you're such a public figure, you have to know that this is it. If he decides he wants to run for president, in my opinion, he can't win without her, because the women of America need a role model. And the role model isn't going to be somebody who's yeah. not attached and connected to us. This is my feeling. And I'm like, and my husband's like, no, you're wrong. I'm surprised you feel this way. Really, you know what about setting your own boundaries and limits and setting your own definitions for your job and all this kinds of stuff. And I said, yeah, but still, the main thing is you have to be there with him. Imagine a Rebbe who didn't come to shul on Sabbath. Like, that's what it is. She doesn't go to shul on Sabbath. She doesn't go to any shul event, any shul dinner. She doesn't write an ad in the journal. She doesn't, I mean, like, certainly doesn't have classes, you know, but like, oh, okay. So then, a couple days later, there was an editorial by Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. Have you heard of her?
Yes.
She's not married. I've searched and searched and searched on the internet. There is much speculation, but no, she is not. She wrote, which you'll see in a moment why I mention it, she wrote an op-ed column, "The Doctor is Out." Very clever title. I don't know if she gives the title to whatever. So here she goes. Okay, this I'm going to read the whole thing because it's short. This is good. Okay? "Not satisfied with colonizing the moon, scouting for Martians, and civilizing Iraq, President Bush is lavishing more gazillions on another audaciously quixotic plan." She writes well. "He wants to become the national Yenta. As Robert Pear and David Kirkpatrick wrote in the Times, administration officials are planning an extensive electioneer initiative to please conservatives in a swivet over gay marriage. Their social engineering scheme will try to shore up traditional marriage, offering training to couples in the interpersonal skills needed to achieve and sustain healthy marriages. Before Mr. Bush ventures into the inner cities to practice his conjugal noblesse of liege, perhaps he should beeline to a more rural spot, a split-level ranch house with green shag carpeting and Grateful Dead albums in Burlington, Vermont. The doctor's dean seems to be in need of some tips on togetherness and building a healthy political marriage, if that's not an oxymoron. Even by the transcendently wacky standard for political union set by Bill and Hillary Clinton, the deans have an unusual relationship. She is a ghost in his political career. She's never even been to Iowa, and most reporters who have covered Howard Dean's quest here the last 2 years would not recognize her if she walked in the door, which she is not likely to do since she prefers examining patients to being cross-examined by voters and reporters." Let me put it that way. I mean, I understand. "The first hard evidence most people had that Howard Dean was actually married came with a straggling picture of his wife on the front page of Tuesday's Times accompanying a Jody Wilburn profile. You should just know, not only did I not know that Dr. Dean had a wife, I didn't even know that he was a doctor. Like, this is how involved in politics."
No.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he was the first doctor.
Yeah, he knew that.
Okay. And he was, you see, I like, this is how involved I am in politics. Every morning I wake up in a panic. I say, how am I going to know who to vote for if I don't meet up any of this stuff? And then the whole day goes by.
Jewish there was a whole yard.
Yeah.
I think that if he is truly an outstanding leader, why should we pass him by? Because she's not involved. If he is.
So this is my question.
And I'm in the Jewish house.
So this is my question to you. What do you think about it? Do you think that it's important for her? I mean, you clearly know what I feel about it. Do you think that it's important for her to play a major role, or at least a visual role, at least to be seen standing next to him, at least to show, maybe not all the time, but occasionally to bow out of the open house? How many times a year do you have an inaugural open house?
But look at the present wives of first ladies who have done that and how they've been vilified. Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, that's good.
Okay? The public ripped her to pieces because she was such a big part of his administration, and she was at every of the conventions.
I mean, she overdid it.
But if it hadn't been for her, a lot of the initiatives that we now know wouldn't have even gotten anywhere.
Right.
Well, she's always been very admired.
Hillary Clinton, not during the 40s, she was vilified. She was ripped apart. Hillary Clinton was ripped apart.
For
her health care policy. Right. She tried to establish a health care policy the first year, and they crucified her.
Okay. Nancy Reagan
was always there, but Bess Truman stayed out of the limelight.
She did.
Did she at least
show up at the inaugural ball? Wasn't she a hostess? She talks about, here, one of the articles, I think it was in the article, talks about different types of, oh, you're right, they did, they met at Albert Einstein. Talks about different types of, here, and this woman wrote this book, Myra Gutten wrote a book on first ladies. In her book, The President's Partner, the First Lady in the 20th Century, she outlined three broad categories: ceremonial, like Bess Truman and Mamie Eisenhower, whose White House role was mainly entertaining; emerging spokeswoman, Jacqueline Kennedy and Pat Nixon, who seized the podium to promote issues important to them; and activist, Eleanor Roosevelt, Betty Ford. Dr. Simer, she said, fits nowhere.
But if you really look at Bess Truman spent most of her time in Independence. She wasn't even in Washington, and she point blank told them, "I don't want
they
to be
educated
there."
Educated
and
like
how
her.
She's very educated. She's a doctor. They were not. None of them.
So you think you're saying that she, the first lady, has the right to decide how she wants to do her role if she wants to be. But you're only talking about someone being totally involved and someone being not involved at all.
The first lady has emerged. The first lady was always in the background. She was always a ceremonial piece. She was there at the president's side, supporting the president. She was a figure.
Okay.
It hasn't been until the 20th century, and now into the 21st century, that the first lady really played any kind of role. Jackie Kennedy was the first.
Okay, so let's go before then.
I'm sorry, Eleanor Roosevelt.
I should say Eleanor Roosevelt. But you were saying something slightly different.
She's very educated. She's a doctor, and it's a very, she's needed by the patients, and he's not a president yet.
Now, do you think that she's going to be able to all of a sudden change her tune?
She's there now in Iowa, standing by side. At the last minute,
you're saying she's coming through. At the last minute in Washington, she'll come through.
He's not president.
Okay. So far, you think that the First Lady does not have to be so involved.
I'm not saying she shouldn't be. I'm saying if that is her position, and that works for
him. So would you vote
him,
for him or not based on that?
I would vote for him based on his record, not whether or not his wife's getting anybody. I mean, I'm not saying I'm voting for him.
You're scary.
We're focusing on his wife. I vote for the person who's running for office. I could care less what his wife is like. I mean, if that were the case, we would have never voted for Jimmy Carter. Look at his brother Billy. Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's true. Okay, Zoya, what can say something?
Maybe she will support him. I mean, this is the media. You know, this is like, they all could be false. You know how they always need a story to say?
Sure.
So you never know. Maybe she needs to be needy, as this lady said, by her patient. Maybe her husband doesn't consider her that she needs to be needed, you know? And maybe her patients, because they need her, and that's how... You know, since you're a rabbit, some people need to talk to you or something like that. So maybe that's how she feels, the same. Maybe she feels that she's going to be in the White House, she can't practice what she wants to do.
So she'd rather practice what she wants to do instead of going to the White House.
Right.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. What did you think?
I think she should show up.
She should show up.
She hasn't been there long.
She's in Iowa now.
Is this like a super feminist thing, what she's doing?
No.
No.
I don't think so.
You think it's a pro-feminist or anti-feminist thing that she's doing?
I think she's a dedicated doctor. Her patients are in Vermont, and that's where her career is.
Okay, let's talk about, we were talking about Eleanor Roosevelt, we're talking about Jackie Kennedy. Let's think pre-50s.
Jackie Kennedy was different.
Okay, pre-50s, or 50s included. The role of the wife was very different than the role of the wife that we view it as today.
Uh-huh.
Let's call post-50s the feminist era.
Post-60s,
really. 60s and therefore till now. The feminist era. And before then, the pre-feminist era. So that's what I'm talking about when I say feminist. Okay? Here, she is promoting herself as an individual as opposed to herself as a partner.
It might be overwhelming. Some of those first ladies.
Oh, for sure.
I was in Washington at that museum, and some of them had nervous breakdowns that they couldn't cope with.
I can imagine.
They couldn't cope with that role. So maybe she's hanging on to this for her sanity.
She's running around like a private person. She seems like she's interested in her own thing. But what about the idea that there are certain public positions that when there's a leader, that just like, in here we could go a little feminist here, just like men need a leader, that women need a leader.
If a doctor, then she would be standing there promoting some
in her personality.
Room in the house.
Okay,
in the
so
house.
I'm not asking her to step out of her personality. The question is, if we're looking at a couple, or if we're looking at a president, which is important, a first couple or a president?
Not the first.
Okay.
If the president is halfway smart, you want the president.
Okay.
If she's a whole lot smarter than he is, like
okay.
in many cases,
okay.
then you need a couple. I mean, that's
but whether she
a bunch
is,
of those.
Not for sure, but whether she is a public figure or a private figure, you can tell very clearly who's by her husband's side and who isn't, how many things she shows up to, and how many, you know, there are certain bottom line areas.
Who are you thinking of when you say, if the husband is not so smart, then we need a couple.
Yeah.
Well,
I think
we have a couple
so
of
smart, but I don't think Ronald Reagan is that.
No, no, he, no.
And
he
you know, there
Israel.
Are a few others along the way that.
Well,
we're not exactly, you know. I think Lady Bird is smarter than her husband.
Lyndon Johnson was brilliant.
Yeah,
it was Lady Bird.
She was
I mean, she was a business owner
in
her own right.
Four. Okay. So it seems that I am alone here, although I may be, you know, overly defensive, giving my magic. I view myself as a first lady.
She'll vote for you.
She'll vote for me. You know, what about this idea behind every successful man is
a woman?
Right. I always say, you know, there's two pages. No, I always say behind every successful rabbi is a woman who remembers everyone's name.
But you know, there, we've had bachelor presidents, we've had political couples.
Right, but even who is that? Now you know, I see you know your history. Because there was a president. Okay, there you go. Okay, now, there was a president who wasn't married, so he had his niece come be a hostess for him.
Andrew Jackson.
Okay. Oh, I did a report on him. That's how I knew.
Yeah, we had a couple up in action. It was Andrew Jackson.
Okay.
Grover Cleveland married in the White House.
Yeah, he was the one I was thinking of.
Woodrow Wilson was became a widower and then married a year later, and then his wife became the first female president when he had a stroke.
Right. But nobody knew about
it. Nobody knew about it.
Right. Okay. Let's go with this Andrew Jackson. Okay, let's go with Andrew Jackson. Why did Andrew Jackson need a hostess in the White House? Why did his niece need to come?
Because there's always going to be a ceremonial piece to the presidency.
Right.
It does not necessarily, especially in this day and age,
okay.
equate to having to be a spouse.
Okay.
Right.
You see, what was that movie? What's his name? What was that movie with the president? Yeah, was that it?
Oh
my gosh, right. So same kind of thing. Okay, anyway, fine. So where would we look? I mean, you all have it in front of you, so you can really cheat, but where do we find in Tanakh the description of the quintessential woman?
Mishlei.
Right, Mishlei. You paraclimate. Oh, Asher Kyle. So who wrote Mishlei?
Shlomo Melech.
Good job. Okay, Shlomo Melech wrote Mishlei, and he knows quintessential women because he had
a thousand
wives.
He
takes the best qualities of each of them. Okay, I wonder if you count up the words. No, it's not going to come to 1,000. Okay. Eshet Chayil Miyamza. Who will find, I put on my own notes, with what a rare find is a capable wife. I put question mark around capable because, I don't know if I would translate it as capable. We often translate it as a woman of valor. An Ish Chayil is a man of stature, bravery, of courage, of substantialness.
I think capable is a great word here.
Okay. You know, it was beautiful. I don't know how many of you were at the concert at Akiva on Saturday night, but Marachana was honored, and Mrs. Sadie had the choir sing the end of Eshet Chayil with, instead of saying, like, she had, the end of it was, she started from Pasuk Chavchesh, said, Kamu Talmidaha Vayashuha, instead of her children come up and declare her happy, her students come up and declare her happy. I don't remember what the rest of it was. One of them was Menahala, her administration, and whatever. They all praise her. Said Rabot Morot Asu Chayil. Many, many teachers did great jobs. The Marachana Alta Al Kuana. I'm like crying.
Oh, wow.
It was so beautiful. I mean, the choir is singing it.
Shalami does such a great job with that choir.
Yeah, she does.
Everybody
but
you understand the words though.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
They're a little tricky.
Yeah, but you could see where everyone knows the song, so you could see what was thrown in.
Oh.
You can see where the Marachana was thrown in, and that's just touching, even if you know. But if you see also Rabot Manot. Right here in Pasuk Chastet, you have, and the English translation, many women have done well. You know, Asu Chayil has done well, but Eshet Chayil at the beginning they translate as capable. Okay, capable, you like it, good. Okay, So the capable woman, the woman of valor, is difficult to find. She's as rare as pearls. Batach ba leiv ba'ala, the heart of her husband depends on her. V'shalal lo yachsar, and he lacks no good thing. And Chazal look at this and they say, who is Shlomo HaMelech talking about? Who is the Eshet Chayil in source number 2? Eshet Chayil means Zosara. She is the quintessential Eshet Chayil. And then they proceed to go through the entire Eshet Chayil, or most of it at least, and parallel the different Sukkim from Eshet Chayil with Sukkim in Sarah's life. It's a very nice kind of thing. It starts with Zosara. How do we know that Sarah is the Eshet Chayil? As it says, all the sources that I brought you here, if you want to look to chapter 12, which is what we looked at last week, 2 weeks ago. Sorry, Bereishit. Perek Yudbet, right in the beginning of Parashat Lech Lecha. Mm-hmm. Right when they're going down to Mitzrayim, and we have the famous incident with Paro. Perek Yudbet, Pasuk Yud. Aleph, when they're coming close to page 56 and 57.
Yeah.
It occurred as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarai, see now I have known you are a woman of beautiful appearance. So that pasuk is a proof that she was the Eshet Chayil. The Rachok Mipini Mechra, her price is farther, is harder to find than far beyond rubies. Shebat Miracharka, she came from a very far place. Batach ba leiv ba'ala, her husband puts his confidence in her. They say, Yishana'amar lema'an yitavli ba'avurech, which is just a little bit further in our Pesukim, because he says in Pesuk Yud Gimel, Imrina achotiyat, say that you are my sister, lema'an yitavli ba'avurech, so that good things will be done to me on your behalf. He trusts her, he has confidence in her, that she'll keep him alive. V'shalal lo yachsar, and her husband lacks nothing. No good things. Yeah, Abraham, that's talking to Abraham, her husband, Shinamar, when he leaves Mitzrayim, the Torah describes him in Parak Yom HaPasuk Bet, on page 58, Va'avram kaved ba'od b'miknah b'kashav b'mizahav. That Avram is very heavy and laden down with lots of cattle and gold and silver. And this is how the Midrash says that Sarah is the quintessential woman. And if you look through here, truthfully, in Eshet Chayil, and I'll just read down the English translation for a moment, much of her description is related to her husband, her relationship with him. What a rare finds is a capable wife. Her worth is far beyond that of rubies. Her husband puts his confidence in her and lacks no good thing. She's good to him, never bad all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax and sets her hand to them with a will. She's like a merchant fleet bringing her food from afar. How many of you drive out to Mayans? She rises while it is still night, 6:15 a.m., ladies, and supplies provisions for her household, the daily fare of her maids, or, well, children. She sets her mind on an estate and acquires it.
True, true.
She plants a vineyard by her own labors. She girds herself with strength and performs her tasks with vigor. She sees that her business thrives. Her lamp never goes out at night. That's the 12 o'clock at night, I didn't tell you that. She sets her hand to the distaff, her fingers work the spindle. That means she weaves. She gives generously to the poor, her hands are stretched out to the needy. She is not worried for her household because of snow, for her whole household is dressed in crimson. She makes covers for herself, her clothing is linen and purple. Her husband is prominent in the gates, and he sits among the elders of the land. She makes cloth and sells it and offers a girdle to the merchants. It sounds like she's really working kind of hard, and he's sitting with his feet up, but we can discuss that another time.
She
is clothed with strength and splendor. She looks to the future cheerfully. We'll be talking about this tonight because we spoke about it last night. Her mouth is full of wisdom, her tongue with kindly teaching. She oversees the activities of her household and never eats the bread of idleness. Her children declare her happy. Her husband praises her. Many women have done well, but you surpass them all. Grace is deceptive. Beauty is illusory. It is for her fear of the Lord that a woman is to be praised. Extol her for the fruit of her hand, and let her works praise her in the gates. So why is her husband, what the symbol of her husband sitting in the gates, by the way, is he's not sitting with his feet up. That the metaphor, the phrase in, what's that?
The minister?
He's a judge. Yeah, the judges are the ones who sat in the gates of the city, meaning her husband is a prominent community man who involves himself in the world outside of the home in righting the wrongs of the community. And she, to enable him to do that, keeps the inside of the home intact. One of the things that was said last night at the mikvah, Rabbi Sturka said this in the beginning, that the Gemara says that a man calls his wife his diet. That, you know, there are a few, I meant to bring you a photocopy of it, you don't have to take my word for it. That the Gemara says that the man calls his wife his diet. That why is a woman compared to a bayit to the house? Because the house protects the inside from the elements. The woman also protects her family from the outside elements. The woman's job is that of shmira, of protecting her family, and the shmira, the protecting mitzvot. That's why women, he said, also connected this to the concept that women are obligated in all of the lo tashei mitzvot, the mitzvot that you have to do that you're not allowed to do. Women are obligated in all the don'ts. Because the don'ts are all protective, to keep a protective covering, and that's what the woman's job is, and that's what her nature is, to protect her family. You know, he said it, you know, in his way of saying it. But okay, so let's talk about Sarah's relationship with Abram. Did they work together? Were they a, let's use some examples. Were they a presence who worked together, not where she was overpowering.
Political couple.
Okay. Or were they a dean and Dr. Dean, you know, who sort of did their own thing. So first, I want you to do something that's going to be very hard for you, but I know that you can handle it. Okay? Just turn the page before, because I always give challenges that I know you can handle. The challenge is as follows. To read the pasuk without looking on the bottom stuff. Okay, in the Chumash, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Just to read it in Hebrew and the English.
Which one?
Okay, I'll tell you in a second, my gosh. Okay. Well, on page 54 and 55, Hashem said to Avram, go for yourself from your land, from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land that I will show you, and I'll make you a great nation. I'll bless you, make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and he who curses you, I will curse, and all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you. And here's what I want to look at. So Avram went as Hashem had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Avram is 75 years old, and he left Haran. And I'm going to read Pasuk Hey in Hebrew and in English. Vayikach Avram et Sarai ishto. Avram took Sarai his wife, v'yat Lot ben Achiz, and Lot the son of his brother, v'et kol rechusham, and all of the wealth, and asher v'chashu, all the wealth they had amassed, and the souls they name in Haran, they do la lachar Kanan, and they left to go to the land of Canaan, Bevo Arta Kanan, and they came to the land of Canaan. And the phrase I want to focus on for the next few minutes is Hanafash Asher Asu B'Haran. And those of you who have learned the Rashi on this before are not allowed to answer. And everybody who didn't learn the Rashi, or unless if you have another idea from Rashi, what do you think it means, without looking at the bottom, Hanefesh asher asu v'charat. They're bringing themselves the rechush asher v'chashu. They're bringing all the wealth they had amassed, and the souls they asu, they made in Haran. Think, and I'm going to count to 10 in my head, and then I'll take suggestions. Okay, suggestion.
Well, wasn't he doing kibbutz or conversions? Or
how do you get that
Jewish?
From here?
Well,
who wasn't
here?
Avram.
I mean,
Avram wasn't Jewish.
But he already had believed in the concept of a God.
Okay.
And wasn't he destroying idols and trying to get people to not be idol worshippers?
Show me.
In the past.
Show me the pasuk. We're not looking below the line.
No, I'm just saying from past.
Oh, from the
not from this line. From not from.
Not from
the
Torah. Yeah. No, not from any pages.
From Hebrew school.
From the Midrash. You know, from the Midrash that he was knocking down those idols.
Well, I'm actually going, you know, trying to spread the word of one God.
Okay.
So his converts, I'm saying.
So how do they
interpret
them
the souls? The people. I don't know why they use the word souls.
people that they made believe that God
saved.
So why does it say the souls that they saved or the souls that they converted? Why does it say the souls that they made?
The followers.
Souls that they made.
The spiritual followers.
So why the confusing language? The souls that they made.
Because they weren't like co-workers.
Okay.
They were souls.
That they formed, that they, they brought from something else and changed into something.
And they were still in the process.
Okay, and they were still in the process. Mm-hmm. I want you to look up, where are we? No. Okay, I want you to look up in Bamidbar, Perek Chaf Daled, 29. No, this doesn't make sense. No, forget that. It's not going to work. Okay. In Devarim, there's a place where Hashem tells the Jewish people, be careful when you get to the land, because you can fall into a trap. Mm-hmm. Ah. Here we go.
What page?
Not sure yet. Okay. Page 984. On the margin on page 985, it says, a warning against the lure of prosperity. Take care lest you forget Hashem your God by not observing His commandments, His ordinances, His decrees, as I command you today, lest you eat and be satisfied, and build good houses and settle, your cattle and sheep and goats increase, and you increase silver and gold for yourselves, and everything you have will increase, and your heart will become haughty, and you will forget Hashem your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery, etc., etc., says all the good things that Hashem did for you. Verse 17, Pasuk Yizayin, I want you to look in the Hebrew for a moment. And at this point, this person who had all these good things and forgetting about God will say, you'll say in your heart, Kochi va'otsem yadi asali et hachayil hazeh. My power and the strength of my hand asa for me this wealth. And in the English, indeed it says, my strength and the might of my hand made me all this wealth. Okay, so I'm now showing you another place in the Torah in which the word asu, or asa, is used as how?
Made.
Or acquired or something like that. But back to our text. What can we use? Take that information, because the same word will mean the same thing we assume in multiple places. So anafash asher asu b'charan, the people that they
made.
Acquired. And come on, do you change your view? We seem to have a unanimous view until this point. We're talking about converts or spiritual followers. Change your view or keep your view?
Well, that's the only way that souls would come into the picture. You know, a soul is a spiritual thing.
Or a soul could be representative of a person.
Yeah. That's true.
But not just anybody would have gone with them.
Right.
He would have had to...
People who he, asu, how did we translate the word asu?
Formed.
Made.
Or, you don't form your wealth.
Acquired.
You make your wealth or acquire.
Acquired.
So it could be people that he acquired.
Slaves.
Another possibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have two possibilities here. People he converted based on the fact that we're talking about souls, and people that he bought based on the verb asu and how it shows up at another place in the Torah. Okay, let's look at Rashi. You could look in the book, you can look on here. I have it, it's all over. Source number 3. Asher asu b'charan. Rashi likes your first interpretation. Shehech nisan tachat kanfei shchina. The text indicates that Abraham had brought them in under the wings of divine presence. And then he adds an interesting note. Abraham, why does it say asu in the plural? If Abraham was the big converter, he was the big, I like to call him, the first entity is why advisor
of the year. The women.
So why is it in plural? So Rashi answers, Abraham megayeret ha'anashim, the Sarah megayeret ha'anashim. Abraham did it for the men, Sarah did it for the women.
Since they converted them, the Torah considers it as if they made them, as if they formed them, because they gave meaning to their lives, let's say. Okay, that's interpretation number one, and he says, but he admits, but this is not the real, like, bottom line, most straightforward meaning of the text. The most straightforward meaning of the text, and the slaves and handmaids that they had acquired for themselves. Kimo, just like, and he quotes other psukim in which the word asha is talking about acquiring wealth. So that the word osed denotes acquiring and gathering. Fine. So we have here our two interpretations, either that it was people they converted, and if it was people that they converted, then why is it plural instead of singular? Because they worked really hand in hand. So now I want to introduce you to the concept, and we've spoken about this, some of you have taken some of my classes before, to the concept of Midrash and how it focuses into Rashi's interpretation. Rashi, some of you, those of you who had a yeshiva education for sure have heard this, who've had a day school education, for sure have heard that Rashi brings the simplest meaning and most straightforward meaning of the text, in Hebrew referred to as Pshat. That's not true. If you learned it, it's not true. Rashi doesn't do that, and he admits himself that he doesn't do that. Did you learn that?
No.
Okay, good. What Rashi says is he brings a midrash that is closest to the simple meaning of the text. What's a midrash? A midrash is a collection of interpretations that were written down around the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara from, let's say, the year... about 100 to 500 CE. Okay, that's when these midrashim were written down. These are oral traditions either passed down from Moshe and Har Sinai all the way down, or ways that the rabbis found that they could interpret the text in ways that applied to that made sense to the people that they were dealing with. Fine. That's what Rashi does. He takes one of those midrashim, says, which one fits in the best with my text? Makes it flow, and here we go. That's what he brings. His first interpretation is what we call a midrash. Midrashic interpretation, because clearly from the text it doesn't say anything about converting. Okay, that's Rashi. Now at the same time that Rashi lived, but not necessarily corresponding with each other, in a totally different part of the world, we have this guy named Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra. His father's name was not Ezra, his last name was Ibn Ezra. His father had another last name, I just found this out a few months ago. Very interesting little tidbit. Ibn Ezra says, okay, I don't want any of this Midrash stuff. I mean, it's nice and everything, but really I'm here to explain, bottom line, what the text is talking about. So here's what he says, and this is source number four. The Et HaNefesh HaMan, the bold words at the end of the first line. Avadim Yilidei Bayit. Servants and children of the household, meaning children born to the servants. Oh, Asu Kamo Kanu, or servants that they bought. Tzvachem Ashali Tzachayel Hadeh. Just let me quote the pasuk that we just looked up, that I have acquired for myself well. And now he says something very interesting that he very rarely does. He quotes the Midrash. The Yeshomrim, he says. And there are those who say, HaNefashot Shehorum HaEmet Lavodet Hashem, the souls that they educated in the way, the truth, to know how to serve God. Like, Ibn Ezra, you're not into this stuff. Why are you all of a sudden bringing this in? Because someone before him, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not losing anybody here. Somebody before him, who's really also a translator and a literal interpreter, also brought in the Midrash. And that's Unklus. The first edition of Art Scroll, Chumash, before Art Scroll, was written by a man named Unklus, who was a convert to Judaism, who took upon himself the massive task of translating the entire text of the five books of Moses into the native language in Israel at that time, Aramaic. He translated it word for word, sticking as close as he possibly could to the literal meaning of the text. He never brings in Midrashim, because why would you bring in a Midrash if you're translating, right? The souls that they mean in Quran. That's a translation. Uncle says, I didn't underline it for you, but it's on the last line of the Unklus. I gave you the fourth line, the first three words. How does he say? Well, you could look at the end of the third line. The Yat Nafshata, the Es HaNefesh, the souls. The Se'avidu Le'oraita the Charan. I don't know a whole lot of Aramaic, but the Se'avidu is like Abdu, right, to serve. Le'oraita, I know that word.
like, because we know we go to Rabbanan, rabbinic commandments, and we go to Oraita, which are Torah commandments. The Haran, in Haran. Hanefesh Asher Asu B'Haran, he translates as the people that they convinced to serve the Torah, to keep the Torah, in Haran. This would have been a good one when we spoke last term about if the Avot kept the Mitzvot or not. Fine. Okay. So now we have a very strong tradition putting us in this position that Avram and Sarah worked together to bring in these people, to convert them and educate them in the ways of the Torah. Okay. Now, look at this pasuk again. Let's say that the Yashu is referring to multiple people. Let's say that the Hanefesh Asher Asu B'Haran are the people that they are converting. But there is another very possible possibility, taking what we know about the social structure of the time period, as to who those multiple people were who were converting other people. And it's not necessarily Abraham and Sarah. Because what was the position of the woman in the social structure in ancient times?
The home.
Very strongly. She wasn't a public figure at all. Mm-hmm. So what's our other possibility if you look at the text? Who else should it be? Abraham? No, it's plural. It's plural. Asu. It's plural. Who's the other one working with Abraham? Look in the pasuk. If it wasn't Sarah, who else could it be from the pasuk? Exactly. And that's what Radak says. Radak, who we had so much fun with last week. Number 6. He says, bottom line, simple interpretation, the servants and maidservants that they bought in Haran. The Yashu, and like he made them. Okay, but look in the third line. The Jat Unkelus, he has a problem, because he can't say that that's really the only interpretation, because the Unkelus brings in this whole conversion thing. The Jat Unkelus, Alotaman Hashim Shech Ziram Lenunatoba. Unkelus has an opinion that these are the people who were brought back, who are Chozrim B'tshuva, to the good Emunah, which is the faith of Avraham Avinu, ki Lot Hayam Emunato, that Lot was of Avraham's belief, the Zichach Mitchaberimo, therefore the two of them were included together, v'hu gam kim kamei l'anashim, and Lot was also calling to people, umar Elohem ta'amim, and showing them reasons, she'aminu b'Hashem v'yavduoto l'vado, that they should believe in God and serve Him only, v'lo ha'elilim, and not the other gods. V'zichach amar asher asu, v'lo asher asa. Why is the plural, says Radak, because Sarah for sure was not involved in this thing, because the woman was barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. And here we have, it had to be Lot and Avram working together. It doesn't even entertain the thought of Sarah. But he can't walk away from it, because he knows the Midrash is so strong, and he finishes up, but I know that the rabbi said, Asher Ashu al Avram v'Sarai, hu megayar ha'anashim, v'Sarah megayar ha'anashim. I know what Chazal said, that Avram and Sarai worked hand in hand, he did the men, she did the women. And then he explains another example of where Moshe and Aaron, with the same verb of Asu, shows up with Moshe and Aaron, that they also were converting people. But he, like, reluctantly entertains the possibility of Sarah being a driving force side by side with her husband in the conversion of everyone. Okay. So here's my theory that I present to you. I think that this is it. I think that Sarah and Avram worked side by side, hand in hand, in converting and convincing the world to believe in monotheism. And why do I think that? Let's look in Parak Yud Zayin. Chapter 17. Okay, this is right after the section that we spoke about last week. And here we have, we're on page 72 and 73. Avram is 99 years old. His name at this point is still Avram. Hashem appears to him, says to him, I'm God, walk with me, be perfect, we'll make a deal.
Avram throws himself down and says, God, and God says, here, you're going to be the father of multitude of nations. And then he says in verse 5, your name shall no longer be called Abraham, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. Your name will no longer be Avram, but Avraham, because you are Av Hamon Goyim. I'm adding the hey to expand your name to show you that you now have a larger goal, that you and I are not the only ones in this equation anymore, that you now have a responsibility and obligation to the rest of the world to enlighten them, an official obligation to enlighten them as to my oneness, etc., etc. And he continues and he says, okay, I'm going to give you all kinds of good things to get Eretz Yisrael. And he says, and I want you to give a brit milah, give a circumcision to everyone from your household as a sign of our deal. And look in verse 15, Pasuk Tedvar, Vayomer Elokim al Abraham, Sarai ishtecha lo tikrat shema Sarai, ki Sarah shema. Don't call her Sarai anymore, because her name is Sarah. Isn't that interesting? If you look back where it says about Avram, he's changing Avram's name. He says, Loi karei od et shemcha Avraham v'hayah shemcha Av... Sorry. Loi karei od et shemcha Avram v'hayah shemcha Avraham. He says, do not, your name will no longer be called Avram. Your name will in future be called Avraham. But in Sarah, he says, do not call her Sarai, because Sarah is her name. Is her name being changed, first of all? Not so clear. It could be that her name is Sarah. What does Sarah mean? Yes. What does Sarai mean?
My princess.
So God is saying to Abraham, Sarah is no longer just yours, and she's no longer just mine. She's not Sarai. Just like your job is expanded and now you have an obligation to everybody, Sarai becomes Sarah. She is everybody's princess. And this is what the Gemara tells us in source number 7. Avram hu Avraham. Avram's name gets changed to Avraham. Batchila nesha av la'aram. In the beginning, he was a father only for Aram, which is the area that he came from. Ulebasof nesha av l'chol ha'olam klo. And in the end, he was made a father for the entire world. Sarai hi Sarah. Why? Batchila nesha tsarai lu. Matan, in the beginning, she was my princess only for her nation. Ulebasof nesha tsarai l'chol ha'olam klo. At this point, both, just like Abraham's goal and purpose and focus is changing from internal, from personal, to national, or even multinational, Sarai gets the same instructions. She gets the same treatment, she has the same obligations, she has the same everything. And she gets the same blessings too, right? In the next pasuk, after her name is changed, she's called by Sarah, says, I'll bless her, I'll give her a son, her ultimate, what she always wanted, she's going to have. So now the question is the relationship changing because she's not a mother? Is it that it's assumed that she has time now to spend, you know, because she's not busy with her children? And I propose to you, no. What happens to her after she becomes a mother? If you look in the stories, until this point, at almost every single point in the story, Sarai is with Avram. Even at the end of a couple more chapters from here, at the end of chapter 20, page 93, 94, when the whole incident happens with Abimelech, when they go down to Gerar, and Avram for the second time pretends that Sarai is his sister, Abimelech speaks to Sarah directly. He says to her, verse 16, and to Sarah he said, behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, let it be for an eye covering for all who are with you, and to all you will be vindicated. He speaks directly to Sarah. Sarah still has a very public role here. But then, it seems at this point, now Hashem remembers Sarah. Sarah gives birth to a child. And now her concern is shifted somewhat. And her new concern is her son Yitzchak. Yitzchak is born. They have the big party, the big feast. And then she notices that after the child is weaned, she notices on page 97 and 96, verse 9, Pasuket of Parakafalos, chapter 21, Batere Sarah ben Hagar Hamitrit Asher Yadala Abraham Mitzachek. Sarah sees the son of Hagar the Egyptian, who was born to Abraham, laughing. Now all of a sudden her focus is different. Batomer La'Avram, she says to him, God Resha Amahazos Bethana, chase out this maid and her son, Kilo Yirash Ben Hamahazotin Beni in Yitzchak, because the son of this maidservant will not inherit together with my son, Yitzchak. All of a sudden her focus seems to be changed. What was he doing? What was he laughing at? What's the translation here? He was mocking. He was mocking. So I brought you Rashi and source number 8 on the bottom of page 2. Mitzachek, making sport. Rashi gives several possibilities. Possibility number 1, Lashon Avodah Zarah. Idol worship. Possibility number 2, Zavar Acher Lashon Giloy Arayot. Inappropriate relationships. Source number 3, murder. What was the murder? Yishmael and Yitzchak were arguing about the inheritance, and Yishmael said, I am the first one who should take two portions. They went out into the field. Yishmael took his bow and shot arrows at Yitzchak. The big three, Rashi says it could have, the big three, murder, inappropriate relationships, and idol worship. These are the big three things that we have to risk our lives for. Like, I always call them the big three. I know in Detroit the big three refers to something else. But here we're talking about, like, the three most severe, most serious sins. Rashi is accusing him of the three most severe, serious sins. Why? Because Sarah wouldn't chase him out for nothing. But it's not that Sarah sees simply that Yitzchak, her son, is being affected. I want to present to you that her focus is always to the future. Is to the Am, is to who Yitzchak is supposed to be. And I'm getting that from the next Rashi. I don't know if you have an English translation of the Rashi, but the next Rashi, in Bini in Yitzchak, Rashi focuses on the fact that take which one you want. If you want to send him out because it's my son, fine, send him out because he's my son. But I want you to focus on something else. He's Yitzchak. He's not simply my son. He is the father of the next generation of monotheists. Here we have already an example of somebody who's knocking away. Now, these three things are part of the seven laws that were given to Noah. The things that any basic, decent human being doesn't do. We're talking about the future of the greatest people ever, that God said is going to bless them always. Think about that. They can't be exposed to and relating to these kinds of things. So I present to you, ladies, and you may disagree with me, I welcome it. I present to you that Sarah was not simply a partner with her husband as a mother to her child, because it's something that's very interesting, just to leave you with a question. In the most significant event of her child's life, she is absent. She's not there. Not only is she not there, Rashi says, her death written immediately after the Akedah, because the Satan came to her and showed her what was happening. She didn't know about it. The Satan came and showed her an image of what was happening on the top of Har HaMoriah, and she died. Adam, how could you do this? Right. My understanding of these texts is not simply as a mother, but as a partner with Avram in bringing up not just the next generation, not just her child, but a nation. She was Sarah. She was the leader of the nations. And I wanted to end on this positive note of Sarah, because last week we got very down on her. But to realize that Sarah really was a mother of nations, and that she did work together with her husband, and that they did work together. And I also present to you that if Sarah hadn't been working together with her husband, then only the Anashim would have been converted and not the women, and then where would we be today? Because where does the heritage go through anyway? But
Yeah, so that's so I present to you that Sarah is different from Judith Steinberg Dean, although I very much respect Dr. Steinberg. I very much respect her and I understand her, but I think Sarah understood that in a position of leadership, that it was important, particularly when religion was involved, that it was important also to have the female element to it. It wasn't a plug.
So would you say that Sarah was the original standard bearer of the feminist movement?
Oh, of the feminist movement? I said she was the standard bearer of First Lady, a job description instead of called the class. You could say that, yeah, for women to have their own role models instead of having men to follow.
Absolutely.
You could say that.
That's right. She was never subservient.
No, certainly not. In fact, at this point, just a few verses later, after where we stopped here, she says, send him out. And Avram's like, how could I send him out? He's my son. And then Hashem says, listen to her. She knows what she's talking about. And Rashi learns from there. This brings us back to our first class. Rashi learns from there that Sarah was better, was greater than Avraham in Nebuah, that she was had a closer relationship with God. So, because she knew what was going on. Very amazing. So next week, hopefully, we'll begin a study of Rivka.
There are women, when all these women say that, you know, Judaism is...
that's what this whole class is about. The whole term. So next week, we'll start talking about Rivka. Thank you, Sam.